Just a moment ago, as we were getting ready to start the class, Ron comes in. He says, "That was sure a tedious reading this week." And it was, wasn't it? When you're in Exodus, these last chapters, and particularly again as we start getting into Leviticus, and yet again in Deuteronomy particularly, but especially in the last half of Exodus and in Leviticus, you have very long lists of laws and instructions that are just that, very long list of laws and instructions, laws of which many times have to do with first tabernacle and then temple service, as we get later into our Bibles, which is not being practiced anymore. And so those sections were tremendously important to the Jews. It distinguished them from all other nations. It established them as the chosen people of God with a sacrificial system that they alone in the world's history would ever have, and which established for them a more intimate, close relationship with God that no other nation had. But we're studying 2,000 years after those things were done away. And so for us, we read through these things, and it just, you know, makes you feel like I do when I go into Home Depot and I'm facing the wall that has nails and screws. Whenever I go in and face that wall, I feel like I'm just going to go blind. There's so many different sizes and shapes and types of heads. You know, you want a star, you want a square, you want a Phillips, you want a flathead, you know, what do you want? You know, I just go cross-eyed when I'm in there, and I feel the same way when I'm in the last part of the book of Exodus. Tonight, I am not going to make a whole lot of reference to the text itself. Primarily, everything's going to be focused on the screen here, because we have that advantage now today that many people through the years, people that I think must be half mad, have devoted themselves to the study of that kind of material and doing the best that they can to try and visualize it for us, to recreate it for us. More on that at the end of the class. But they are helpful. These various illustrations and whatnot are extremely helpful. So we're going to be looking quite a bit tonight at photographs which I've taken from this book right here. It's called The Rose Guide, R-O-S-E, Guide to the Tabernacle. There's a companion volume that is The Rose Guide to the Temple. Both of these books are just tremendously helpful. You'll be seeing picture after picture, as I say, in just a minute. What they do is they break down in a wide variety of not just illustrations, but also various types of charts, all this information that we have been studying these last couple of weeks. And it digests it for you, presents it, you know, in sort of a collated kind of a manner. Now, I bring it up because if you have an interest in the tabernacle, if you have an interest in the temple, just independently, that really is kind of the go-to book. It's been around for a lot of years, really, really good. But especially, I want to recommend it for those of you that teach. If you're teaching children's classes, and you're going to be dealing with the Old Testament and this material, you know, at all, then go online, look for Rose Publications. It'll be the first one that pops up. They've been around a long time. They're very famous, very well known, and Google will find it instantly. And make sure you buy a copy. They're not all that expensive, but it's the best tool I've ever found to help with kids' classes or anybody else's in understanding this material. We are in week number 8. Last week we read pages 101 to 116. What you were reading last week is Exodus chapter 28 and verse 1 to the end of the book. So Exodus chapters 28 through 40. In Exodus chapters 28 through 40, you've got a total of 13 chapters there that are dealing with primarily the tabernacle, as we'll see in a minute. But they are also in the last part, the second part of what is a very clear division in the book of Exodus. If you're looking for some sort of an outline on Exodus, it's not hard. There's two parts. Okay. And the first one, as you can see on the screen, is chapters 1 through 19. The first 19 chapters, which we've already covered in the preceding two classes, those are historical. They tell us about the birth of Moses, some of the problems of Moses, the travels of Moses, the call of Moses, the plagues that God visited upon Egypt through Moses and freedom of the Jews from their captivity in Egypt. They read very straightforward as a chronological history of the Jews being prepared by God in their great leader Moses to become their own nation in their own land with their own religion, because they are the fulfillment of the prophecies and the promises that were made to Abraham starting in chapter 12 of the book of Genesis. And then you have totally different material. Starting with chapter 20, there are 21 chapters, 20 through 40, that deal with first some individual laws. A couple of chapters of that. Then we turn to this lengthy discussion of the tabernacle as it is being built for the very first time. And then the priests that are going to be officiating, serving in that tabernacle for about 1,500 years. That tabernacle, it's not that long either. I've forgotten when the first temple was built. For about 500 years, this tabernacle is going to serve these people. And then, of course, in Solomon, they're going to be building a more permanent structure. To break the Exodus down, though, just a little bit more to the reading that we've just concluded, chapters 25 through 40 deal with the tabernacle and the priests. Those were the chapters that we were reading this last week. Here from that Rose book that I was just telling you about is a double-page spread right there. That's just the best one I've ever seen for depicting the center of all things Jewish from Moses to Christ. There were 12 tribes in Israel. These 12 tribes will have a tabernacle that is literally, physically, at the geographical center of all of their camping locations. Each of the 12 tribes has a designated area. They always camp in exactly the same place in relation to that tabernacle. Now, I've seen those charts and I didn't present any for you tonight. But, suppose that on the south side of the tabernacle and in the middle direct south line is where Judah was, then that's where Judah always was throughout what would be 40 years of wilderness wandering, though, as you saw in the reading, the tabernacle will be prepared, what must have taken months and months, in the first year after they left Egypt. And then, on the first day of the first month of their new year, which God had established their calendar and how they would keep time in that same first year, they are now on the exact one-year anniversary of leaving Egypt, going to dedicate this tabernacle and begin its worship. So this, of course, is just an artist's rendition of that encampment then at the foot of Mount Sinai. Now, what you see there in this whirlwind tornado-like structure in the picture is called the Shekinah. The Shekinah is a physical representation of God's presence. It is not a physical representation of God himself. But during the day, there was a pillar of smoke, and at night, it was a pillar of fire. There was always then a light source, even at night, for Israel. The sun during the day, and during the day then, they would be led by that column of smoke. But at night, God's presence is indicated at all times by a pillar of fire that is directly above this tabernacle. That's impressive. The Jews saw this for the first time, of course, as they left Egypt. It played a role, these two columns or pillars, during the attack of Pharaoh with his armies when they came to the Red Sea. And so this is going to be a very dramatic and inescapable demonstration of God's presence for these people for 40 years. Now, as you look at this first photograph, again coming from the Rose publication on the tabernacle, chapters in our reading this week, 26, 27, 29,
30, 31, 35, 36, 37, 38, and 40 are all about what? The tabernacle. That is a lot of detail. Unless you're the kind of guy, you know, like Dean or me, who just loves to look at blueprints. it's tedious reading. It really, truly is. But it was detailed. And when it was completed, it was beautiful, expensive, and enduring. And it was created with miraculous help by God through a couple of men, as you saw in the reading, who were picked. So we're just going to spend a little while here, look at some of these photos, try to give ourselves a general acquaintance with how the tabernacle operated. As a matter of fact, it may be hard to see, but if you look over here, there is a little compass that's been drawn on the photograph. So the entrance to the tabernacle was facing in what direction? To the sunrise. Whenever a priest approaches the tabernacle, he is putting his back to the east. He is walking to the west and therefore entering the tabernacle on a westward journey. And then we have in front of that tabernacle, the structure itself, we'll talk about it in a minute, we have two objects. There's a great altar in which tremendously large numbers of animals were killed and then sacrificed by being burned upon that altar. That is dirty work. I mean, really dirty work. It is hot out there in that desert just almost all the time. It is being officiated here, this worship, by priests who you'll see in a minute are very, very heavily clothed. It doesn't matter if it's 115 out there in the desert. They're wearing four layers of clothes. And then, what are they doing all day? Wrestling with animals and lifting up meat, which is heavy, and working right next to what?
Fire.
It was not fun to be a priest in Israel. It was exceedingly hard work. And once a man got a few years on it, he wouldn't be able to do it anymore. I can't imagine my trying to do any of that work, you know, at the age that I became. It just would be impossible. Keep your radar up for that. Yeah, I don't remember seeing it, but we'll keep our eyes open for it. But nonetheless, this is hard work. Whatever you're wearing, that is hard work. Now, let's try to break this down a little bit. And in the book, it's just great. It actually got transparencies that you can put page after page, one layer after the other, you know, so they build up what was the inner construction of the tabernacle. But here you can see they tried to do a cutaway here to show the four different fabrics that are covering it, to show these planks that were the vertical planks with the metal hooks through which golden bars were placed in order to hold this whole thing together. It is designed to be taken down and transported, but when it is assembled, it is a very stout structure. That thing is serious. It is heavy. And it's not moving in any wind. It is very rock solid construction, very precisely created so that it all fits together, you know, exactly right. And they just assemble the puzzle and boom, they have a beautiful little block right there in which these various articles were presented. Starting with the Holy of Holies, or the Most Holy Place, you have the Ark of the Covenant with what is called the mercy seat on top of it. That is all gold, and this gold has been hammered out, solid gold, to represent cherubim. I am in Hebrew is S in English. So it's a cherub, and in plural you would say cherubim. We say cherubs. We put an S on, they put an IN. So whenever you see cherubim or seraphim, that is the plural of that root word. Here is the presence of God and a depiction that is called a mercy seat, so that the one thing that is most associated with God in the most holy place is mercy. Everyone needs God's mercy. If God gave us justice, what would happen? We first would have our lives snuffed out physically and then eternally. And so mercy is at the heart of all things in any form of worship that you're going to read about in the Old Testament or the New. So there is a very heavy curtain. We sometimes call it a veil, but what do you think of when you hear the word veil? Real light and transparent, you know, and it's nothing like that at all. Extremely thick, utterly impenetrable, you know, through the sight. And that separated then, one-third of the structure is the Holy of Holies, the most holy place, two-thirds of it is the holy place. In the holy place, you have an altar of incense, a specified type of material to burn, and a very precise recipe for aromatic spices that could not be used by anybody for anything other than being placed to produce that aroma within and emanating out from the tabernacle. This is called the table of showbread, or the table of the presence. Upon it are 12 unleavened loaves of bread, apparently representing each of the 12 tribes. Then there is what we call today, what's the one word we use? Menorah, but it is a, don't say candle, lampstand. It is a lampstand. The lampstand had one central column from which it popped with a lamp oil to burn, and then three branches that came out very specifically and very beautifully created. It also had these other bulbs, you know, that they were on it. You saw the description right there. So we do the best we can to try to approximate what it looked like. There, to my knowledge, have only been two archaeological finds that have depicted the one that was taken by the Romans in 70 AD. And so we have some idea, at least, of what first century people were carving, you know, in their walls, their houses, for instance, to give us an idea of what that might have looked like. Now, let's go again, this cutaway version, but this is just another depiction of the planking and then the ties, you know, the rods that went through it to tie it all together. And of course, at the very beginning, again, there is a veil curtain that is very, very heavy. Nobody can pass through this curtain except priests. If you're going to be a priest, what tribe do you have to come from? Levi. Can you be a woman? Never. We were just talking about that with Jimmy when she came in tonight. Men and women have always, Old Testament or New, been judged by God to be absolutely of equal value. There's no distinction made as one being better than the other, more valuable than the other, anything along those lines. However, in both the Old Testament and the New, God does make a distinction between male and female and the responsibilities that they have in their service before Him. These responsibilities are equally valuable to God. They're important, all of them. But they are different. Men do certain things, women do others. So, nobody could pass through that curtain that was not male. And you had to be a male from the tribe of Levi. And then, physically, what about you? Okay, could you have one of these? Trying to dig a postcode yesterday, and one of those gas-powered deals got away from me, and when it did, I let go of the handle, the thing continued spinning, locked in the hole, and then I fell on top of it. That was a scene. So, I was playing like Spider, and his arms and legs, you know, I have bruises like you can't imagine. Okay? Now, I'm going to heal up from that, but if a man had any sort of physical defect, deformation, injury, a broken bone, blemish of some kind on his skin, could he be a priest? No, it was forbidden. So he's not as valuable as the other men. Oh, God loves him just as much. He just can't participate in these particular activities. So let's zoom in again to the Holy of Holies. What was inside the ark, which is the word that just means what? Box. All that word means. Noah's ark is a floating box. That's all it is. Would this box float? Not hardly. Made out of solid gold. Okay? And then you have a rod again for transport. Certain ones would be able to pick it up. You don't carry it. Levites again. And then inside there, you have three things. Actually, technically four, but what are they? You have a jar of manna. The word means
what?
What is it? Okay? And that's what they were fed for the 40 years. Then you've got this object. What is this? Aaron's dead stick, which
budded.
So Aaron's rod that budded. And then the two tables of the covenant. By the way, the tables of the covenant. Did you learn something about the writing that was on them in this week's reading? Okay? They have how many stone tablets?
Two.
And they were written on the front and the back. Very seldom are you ever going to see that. Scripture's quite specific. These Ten Commandments required on those two tablets that they be written out on both sides, not just the one side that you typically see. That, written by the hand of God, was placed within the ark and carried by these Jews all this time. Just outside this extremely expensive, ornate, and beautiful curtain, heavy thing as well, very, very thick, you have three objects, as I mentioned before. Close to the curtain, you have an altar and incense. On the left-hand side, you've got this menorah, the lampstand, and then the table of showbread. And the priests have got work to do. Now, there is not a lot of heavy lifting, but what happens to oil and lamps? Well, it runs out. So what are they going to have to do 24-7? Keep it lit. What happens to a fire that you're burning incense on? It goes out. What are you going to have to do? Keep that thing stoked. Keep that thing stirred. Then God had said, what are you going to do every day with the table of showbread? Replace the bread that was upon it. So these men are Levites with unblemished bodies of a specified age, and a lot more than that when we get to the book of Leviticus, it's named after them, and they can perform this service in here. Who can go through that curtain into the Holy of Holies? One man, called the high priest. How often could he go?
Once a year.
And what was that day? That is the day of atonement. Atonement is what? If I atone for my crime, what have I done? I have paid for it. Once a year, the high priest entered into the most holy place, into the closest presence of God that any human being could get. And while he was there, so he could see the mercy seat itself, then atonement takes place. And if your sins have been covered, forgiven, obliterated, if they have been atoned, then what is God offering to you?
Mercy.
He is forgiving you. Because the blood of bulls and goats, you know full well from the Hebrew letter, does what with sin? Really nothing. The blood of bulls and goats cannot atone for sin. They had to do this in order for their sins to be atoned. I don't really grant that. But what we learned about Jesus the Christ, his blood alone can actually atone. These others are symbolic, they're figurative, they're representative. They are teaching these people for lo these many years about forgiveness, about sacrifice, about atonement. So, you will have read this week in Exodus 25, verses 31 through 40, and again in chapter 26 and verse 35, about this golden lampstand. We don't know exactly what it looked like. Here they've got a real long, center column on it. Well, I don't know. Something like that. And it was being tended by a man who would never allow those flames to die. Again, Exodus chapter 30, in the first 10 verses, you learn about the altar of incense. And you would have also learned both with this altar as well as with the sacrificial altar that was out in the courtyard. It was rather ornate, wasn't it? It has four horns, and since several different altars from the time frame of the Old Testament have been discovered in Israel that have that structure on it, we're really very certain what these horns look like. And then you've got an ornate kind of grill work that went around the border there at the top as well. Again, you had to tend to that. And then, finally, you have the table of showbread. Now, you remember before, the other one was showing high sides and that sort of thing. We don't know precisely, don't have any photographs, of what that original one looked like. We have only the descriptions that you read this week in the book of Exodus. Now, this is the very centerpiece of that book I was telling you about. And what they're doing here is a plastic overlay. So I did the best I could with it, but my camera's having some time focusing, you know, because it was trying to look through that plastic too. But there is this box structure that is the tabernacle. And then it was all covered with what? Can you read at the top? Layer number one was linen. A beautiful fabric was produced with meticulous direction from God that covered the entire ark. And then, what did they put on top of that? A goat skin. Now, a second layer. You can imagine how tremendously heavy this would be. It's fairly large, to say the least. Now it's got to cover this entire structure. What went on top of that? Ram skins. So the ram skins were all sewed together and prepared again by artists. And a third covering was applied, and then a fourth covering, which the Hebrew word is hard to translate, so we're not entirely sure what that is. Some suggest porpoise. Others have sea cow, you know, for the translation there. So I don't know what that is. But obviously, it is a sea creature, and it's the topmost layer. So what was that all about? Okay, it does sometimes rain in those deserts, and they're going to be out there for 39 years with this. And so you have a waterproof covering. What you've got inside that structure, how much light was there? It was as dark as the caves in Albuquerque. Okay, there was no light inside that place, except for the what in the holy place. He had seven branch lampstand that would provide light. Okay, that's it. Now, that brings us to chapters 28, 29, and 39. So you see, they're not arranged, you know, totally by subject matter. The chapters kind of skip around a little bit. We had also information about God telling Moses, this is what I want. And then we have information about God seeing to it that it actually gets produced that exact way that he told them to. So it, both with the tabernacle and with the priest's garments, it comes up a couple of different times. The priests, it wouldn't just be a depiction of a high priest, but the priests would all look something like this. Very, very precisely dressed so that everyone looked exactly the same, save for the high priest, of course, who is quite distinct and distinguished from all the rest. I'm going to start at the feet and zoom in on this same one right here. But every priest, if he goes in to the tabernacle, what does he have on his feet? Nothing. What did God first say to Moses? Take off your shoes. This is holy ground. Okay? So the priests were always barefoot. Hours and hours, heavy lifting, all the work they're doing it barefoot. Then, down here in the white on this drawing is a fine linen tunic. That's a very long garment. Then, on top of that, there is a robe. The color is specified. It's going to have, you know, the bells and the pomegranates around the skirt. So whenever a priest walks, what? He's making a noise everywhere he goes. You can't be a priest and be secret. You can't hide, you know. You're announcing at all times with every movement that you are what? You are a priest. You are a servant of the Most High God. And there's not an instant when you're not. You put those robes on, and now you can't tremor without informing yourself, I'm in the presence of God, you know, I am His priest. Above that is a garment. It was called a what? Starts with an E, an ephod. And again, very ornate. And you can see at the very top there, that actually had what else put around it? A sash was put around it. And as an actual undergarment, what did you also read about? That's 1, 2, 3 layers plus the belt. What was under it all? Okay, trousers or breeches. There's a couple of different terms that are used. This went from the waist down to the thighs. So there was underwear, you know, some sort of pantaloons that were being worn underneath as well. And then, again, remember this is the high priest, not just every priest. But he is now most especially distinguished because he's wearing on his chest and again on his shoulders what? Various stones which are either precious or semi-precious, we would say. Okay? So, we start with the breastplate, and I'll show you another picture of this in just a minute. But the breastplate, how many stones?
12.
Are any two the same stone?
No.
What does each stone represent? A particular tribe. On his shoulders, there are two stones, the same kind of stone, and what is that stone? It's an onyx stone, which is what color? A very black stone. And those are, you know, one on each shoulder. And then you have a mitre or a turban, you know, a head covering that also has an inscription on it. That man is holy to the Lord, and he is representing two different ways the tribes of Israel. On his right shoulder, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Dan, and Naphtali are inscribed. On his left shoulder, Gad, Asher, Issachar, Zebulun, Joseph, and Benjamin are inscribed. On his shoulders and on his chest, he is representing whom? Israel. The 12 tribes of Israel. And when he comes into the presence of God, what does he seek? Mercy for the 12 tribes of Israel. He presents himself as one who has been sanctified, purified, cleansed in a couple of different ways, both the sacrifices and the labor. I had a picture of that labor. Maybe it's coming up later. Okay? And so, in purest form, and with no shoes on his feet because he's on holy ground, he comes to represent Israel, beseeching God for the forgiveness of their sins. These are the actual stones that are listed there. I'm not asking anybody to memorize them, of course. Nobody has, but they are very specific to each of those tribes. Okay, yeah, it is going to come up later, this labor. So, again, Rose, but I've got lots and lots of these pictures, but tonight I thought I'd just keep the scene. In the courtyard, out in front of the tabernacle, and there you can see these curtains, you know, that covered it, you have this altar, which was really quite large. It's not a tiny thing at all. They're putting bulls and goats and sheep, you know, on this thing. But I want you to see this picture. I think it's just so very well done because it serves to illustrate how hard this work is. They're keeping this thing burning hour after endless hour. They've got to provide a tremendous amount of firewood to keep that thing going. It's got to be able to consume large animals, so it's got to be exceptionally hot at all times. What are they doing all day long? They're just stoking that fire. You think those old coal-driven boats, you know, steamboats and stuff, were tough. It'd be nothing like this, I don't think. Just constant action there. You have a lot of utensils that are mentioned in a variety of places. They'll come up again in the book of Leviticus. There'll be a fire pan we're going to hear about with Nadab and Abihu in chapter 10. There's going to be, you know, some forks and spoons and stuff to this use. But sometimes they are boiling things as well as just burning things. It depends. Sometimes it's animals. Sometimes it's various vegetable matter. There's all kinds of sacrifices that are being offered. And at all times, what is somebody handling back in the background? Livestock. You've got livestock from the tiniest to the poorest, offerings of pigeons, you know, all the way up to full grown, year old bulls and whatnot. So, very, very strenuous exercise, this forgiveness of sins. And after they've been involved in those sacrifices, before anyone would go into the Holy of Holies for the table of showbread, for the lampstand, for the incense, he would wash himself in the golden laver. Okay, and the close-up there might have done those in the other order, I guess. Hard, hard work stoking those fires. And so, this is Israel, God's chosen people, who have a physical representation of God by day and by night. They will camp in their respective locations, as designated by God, around this tabernacle. And when will they pack it up and move? When the Shekinah moves, it's time to go, boys. So we pack it up, and wherever the Shekinah goes, what do we do? There we go. Day or night, here we move. That is Israel in Exodus and Leviticus. Now, I do want to hit on just one thing here. Everybody do open, please, now to Exodus chapter 31. That'll be over on page 105 if you have your chronological study Bible. I'd like to read the first 11 verses of chapter 31, and we'll skip over a few pages and look at chapter 36. This, I think, is profoundly important to us to remember. In verse 1 of chapter 31, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "See, I have called by name Bezalel, the son of Uri, the son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah. And I have filled him with the Spirit of God in wisdom, in understanding, in knowledge, and in all workmanship." To do what? What's the next thing it says? To design artistic works. To work in gold, in silver, in bronze, in cutting jewels for setting, in carving wood, and to work in all manner of workmanship. And I, indeed, I have appointed him with Aholiab, the son of Ahithamach of the tribe of Dan. I have put wisdom in the hearts of all the gifted artisans, that they may make all that I have commanded you, the tabernacle of meeting, the ark of the testimony, and the mercy seat that is on it, all the furniture of the tabernacle, the table and its utensils, the pure lampstand, all its utensils, the altar of incense, the altar of burnt offering with all its utensils, the laver and its base, the garments of ministry, the holy garments for Aaron the priest, and the garments of his sons to minister as priests, and the anointing oil and sweet incense for the holy place, according to all that I have commanded you, they shall do. Now turn over to chapter 36. Chapter 36, page 110, right in the middle of the right-hand column there, chapter 36. And Bezalel, and Aholiab, and every gifted artisan in whom the Lord has put wisdom and understanding to know how to do all manner of work for the service of the sanctuary shall do according to all that the Lord has commanded. Now, particularly in that one single verse at the start of chapter 36, what does that verse say you must have if you are going to build a tabernacle? You must have inspiration. Now, I'm going to make a big point out of this. Is Exodus pretty specific? Does Leviticus go into even more detail about the garments and the sacrifices and the tabernacle's construction, all that? There's a lot of information on that. There is. Could you make one today? No. Likewise, much later, 500 years later, when David is given the plans by God for the permanent structure, the temple in Jerusalem, and Solomon, his son, builds that temple according to the divine instruction that was given to David. Could anybody build a temple today? No. In both cases, what is required? Not just the record that's in the text, but what else? You need miraculous divine help. The text gives us a record which is most impressive. We get a visual representation. Rose Publishing can make a whole book out of it. But could you actually do it now? No. The significance of Jerusalem's fall is 70 AD, is that it will mark most summarily and quite permanently the end of what? Moses' sacrificial system ended in September, well, actually before that, but ended, you know, in the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD, and then the temple was burnt down and dismantled in September of that year. Can there be ever the Jewish religion again? No. The text was not designed to give us that religion in toto. You must also have inspired artisans to produce it. So, God created a temporary sacrificial system with priests and a tabernacle, followed 500 years later by a temple, in which, for a grand total of about 1,500 years, the chosen people of God in Israel could perform those sacrifices and acquire the forgiveness of their sins. Knowing all along, does the blood of a goat pay for a sin? No. Will the blood of Christ? Yes. And once that sacrifice was offered, and 40 years were given for the Jews to accept their Messiah, then let there be no doubt, God had created the Jewish sacrificial system. God had detailed meticulously how that was to be constructed and operated. And then, what did God do with it? He destroyed it. God had also created Christianity, a different sacrificial system, a different form of worship, a different religion. And for 40 years, both of these existed simultaneously, side by side, and they were both created by God. And then what? Moses' system was abolished. Grew old, and it disappeared. It can never be resurrected. You meet various religious groups, some that claim to be Christians, saying that the temple's going to be rebuilt, Jesus is going to come back down, he's going to live physically in his old body again for 1,000 years in Jerusalem. Can that happen? Not a word about that in the Bible anywhere. It's a terrible mistake that they've made. Let me go with Greg first with that here.
In Exodus 39 and 30, you left something kind of important.
All right, 39, 30, everybody. Go ahead, Bill. Go ahead, make your point.
Then they made the plate of the holy crown.
What verse are you in, Bill? 39:30.
Then they made the plate of the holy crown of pure gold and wrote on it an inscription like the engraving of a signet, holiness to the Lord. This is kind of the crowning part of the high priest's outfit.
It certainly is. Now read 31, they tied to it a blue cord to fasten it above on the turban as the Lord had commanded Moses. You couldn't look at a high priest without reading what?
Holiness
to the Lord. Is anybody holy in the sense of sin-free? No. What do we need?
Mercy.
And what did this holy priest do? He was involved in God's granting us that mercy. Great, go ahead.
Like you were saying a minute ago, 70 AD is when the laws, the Moses' testimony, the law itself actually died. And Revelation 21 is talking about this very thing. That's when the New Jerusalem descends from heaven, and then the angels of the whole tabernacle of God is among men. It's talking about the church. When you see all these things about the
type and antitype is the whole point of this Old Testament representation. Thank you for that. We have the fulfillment of those things that were representative in the Old Testament. Now we have, Hebrews uses the word what? The substance. Now we have the substance. Okay. Did you look at the chart for your reading this week? Okay. This week you get a week off. We're between Exodus and we're starting Leviticus. Next week I'll teach a standalone lesson in this slot. You've got 2 weeks to get caught up. Go ahead, fess up. How many of you need to catch up? Okay. It's not quite half, but it's pretty close to half. Hey, this is a challenge, isn't it? I know it is. About every 4 months for a year and a half, I'm going to give you a freebie. Okay? So read hard. Read fast.